The important thing is to keep in the mood. If I wish to write a topical book, I must do so with sovereign composure, ironic distance, lucid insight. The dark passion of the professional starveling is antiquated. Nowadays, great literature is a business for sophisticated people, and Gaia's sublime sense of art, her connoisseur's flair, the clarity of her French mind, to which her exotic exterior offers a wonderfully piquant contradiction, challenged me to peak performance, for which I dressed contrapuntally, choosing the attire of Major Thompson, dark grey double-breasted flannel suit with discreet chalk stripes, a tough horse guard seat to the necktie, the feather-light hat from Locke Britishly balanced on the eyebrows, the cornflower in the lapel, an umbrella rolled needle-sharp, Rumpelstiltskin in the dandin. Oh, how good that no one can tell that I'm carrying the Bibliothèque Nationale card in my pocket. Thus absolved of the profane zealotry of working man, I saunter out into a Paris that fits me as snugly as my dogskin leather gloves. Hair is teeming with flaneur, as perhaps the dog that supplied my glove leather once teemed with flies.
This is a novel about an unfinished novel, and it brings to mind a quotation I find I'm using more and more frequently from Theodore Adorno, who says that it's of necessity that any work of art written or produced right now is going to be a work of fragments. Do you agree with that?
Well, partly, you see. I mean, I agree that in literature, the great, perhaps the greatest novel of our time, Musil's Man Without Qualities, has remained a fragment, and perhaps necessarily so, because it was, I mean, its conception was too large, it was too big. Otherwise, you can't cope with nowadays reality without a sort of taking it that large, you see, envision it that large. As for my book, it is an unfinished novel promising a following one, which I seriously intend to write. I'm not revealing a great secret by telling you that it is meant. You see, this book is about a writer who competes with a friend, with his brother Abel, who kills himself for not being able to not even begin, let's say, to finish a book or leave it a fragmentary work. But in the second tome, we shall perhaps find out that the narrator of this book is just an invention of the one who had killed himself. That it would make a sort of double loop, you see. It would make an eight, or if you put it horizontally, the sign of eternity.
Speaking of fragments, Bukovina, the birthplace of the narrator and the birthplace of the author of this book, is a fragment that no longer really exists in and of itself in Europe anymore. To what extent is it important for a narrator from Bukovina to try to put all the traditions acting upon him together? And to what extent is something like this going to be quite difficult, given that the place Bukovina really can only exist in the mind of the historian and in the imagination of an artist these days?
May I allow myself a little correction? The narrator of this book comes from Bessarabia, but it doesn't make a great difference, mind you. I mean, they are both provinces totally forgotten nowadays, both having made part of great empires. You see, the Bukovina was the most eastern part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and culturally a very important part because it was a pool of six or seven nations: Romanians, Hungarians, Poles, if you want to count them among nations, and they were, in a certain sense, Jews, Russians, and so forth, and German settlers. And so it reflected in a small part in a province, is reflected the manifoldness of an empire. And what was rather surprising, even at the time when I was brought up there, which was between the two great wars, during and after, shortly after the First World War, was that cohabitation of all these nations and religions and languages was possible. Now, as to your question, you see, in this book I try to talk about 50 years of European history. The narrator is, and please don't confound him with me personally, it's not an autobiography, it's a, as everything I write, a hypothetical autobiography. Anyhow, the narrator is born in 1919. I was born earlier. But he was born in 1919 and vanishes out of our sight in 68, shortly after 68. So that means 50 years of European history. In these 50 years of European history, the part where he comes from has disappeared. You see, and I mean, as has Europe disappeared in these 50 years. And that's what I wanted to show, that there is a, there used to be a part of Europe which isn't any longer.
But you also said that Europe has disappeared in these 50 years.
Well, it has certainly disappeared. I mean, it was split into two, which means that which means that it isn't existing in its integrity any longer, is it?
No, it isn't. Although there, I suppose there are people who would say that the movement to unify Europe, at least Western Europe, has been much more successful than people would have ever imagined before the war.
Is that so? I mean, the union of Eastern Europe was actually given by the fact of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And you can't cut off the eastern part of Europe from Europe, because you cut out perhaps, an organ which is just as important as its heart or its brain. Do you remember Kundera has once written an exquisite article on the fact that behind the Iron Curtain, in that non-existing part of a non-existing Europe, the only thing that exists much more, in a much greater intensity than in the Western part, that is European culture. It's the only behind the Iron Curtain where really people learn poetry by heart, cite it, come together in order to discuss books and all that. Where does that exist? In our part of the of Europe, if not in very, very small subcultural intellectual circles or something.
Well, I had the experience just spending some time with other writers in Western Europe that it exists to a far greater extent in Western Europe, lamentably, than it does in the United States. Do you, having been born in what we now call Eastern Europe, do you see yourself as an Eastern European writer? And by that I mean as someone with a special affinity for the work of somebody like Kundera, or of modern Polish writers like, for example, Konvitsky or Zbigniew Herbert, or for modern Hungarian writers more than you would for what we would now refer to as Western European writers?
Well, I should think only by the fact that I'm telling of these parts of the world, but I do it in an historical way, whereas they now cope with the actual reality. You see, I have never lived behind the Iron Curtain, fortunately for myself, perhaps. Not fortunately for what I'm writing, because I should have experienced that too. But on the other hand, I mean, history is also necessary in literature, isn't it?
Well, in a lot of these countries, literature really is the surrogate history, because it's, in a certain sense, the realm of autonomy that people can operate in the absence of freedom to act politically.
Well, you see, and also, let us face it, I mean, this is a part of Europe in which history is particularly falsified. And telling the truth about it, and then telling it, shamelessly, as I do, for instance, talking about, let us say, former forms of society, like aristocracy and so on, as not just the evil, which even in our parts of the world they are now being considered as. And I think it's necessary.
Now, the book was originally written in German. Could you tell us a bit about your early life and how you came to be educated in German when presumably people from that part of the world were writing and educated in other languages.
Look, I mean, I was born into a country, as I said, in which six or seven languages were spoken, all badly, see, all in a corrupted way. I was fortunate enough of having had a father who particularly took care of our, that is, my sisters and my language, that is, to speak a language correctly. And, of course, you are immensely enriched by not only hearing and speaking other languages around yourself, but also by taking part, I mean, swapping languages and all that, and you are being brought up. And it is also a great experience to be brought up among people who speak a language in a rather deformed way. I should imagine that an American writer who has been brought up in the South and sort of is enriched by the language, by the black people speak there, you see. The funny thing is that where language decomposes, it becomes, as most things, particularly rich. And, well, then for the rest, I was brought up in Vienna, not only in Vienna, but in Austria, and then in Vienna. So, I mean, I was schooled in German, and I started appreciating the German language as one of the great miracles of mankind. I mean, as a human invention, the German language is one of the great, great achievements of humanity, as are all languages. But I believe that the German language, for many reasons which I would go too far to explain here, is a particular great invention. Whereas the German language has remained more or less of the same stem since it was invented. You see, it has gone through a few changes. But, I mean, it's still very near its own roots.
When this first appeared in Germany, much of it has to do with Europeans coming to terms with their history and with some of the most brutal and tragic moments of recent history. How was that received by German critics? How was the theme and the treatment of this theme received by German critics?
You know, it was received in a German way. That is, Germans have forgotten this past.
You just heard Gregor von Rizzori talking about his new novel, The Death of My Brother Abel. And you're listening right now to the waltz of the Symphonie Fantastique in an homage to the selection of a Frenchman for this year's Nobel Laureate for Literature. The Death of My Brother Abel by Gregor von Rizzori is published by Viking, and Memoirs of an Anti-Semite, which I highly recommend if you're interested in reading something a bit shorter. Death of My Brother Abel is over 600 pages. Memoirs of an Anti-Semite, Gregor von Rizzori, who had just spoke to me. On tape, of course. This is David Darcy. You've been listening to Fine Print. Next week, I'll be featuring an interview with William Murray.